I hope today to finish out chapter 3, 4, and 5, and perhaps get a little start into chapter 6. But what we're looking at is the bondage of Israel in Egypt. God makes a promise that they're going to be delivered, and of course, in order for them to have delivery, they must have a deliverer. And that takes up the entire third chapter, and under the idea of the deliverer, we have four ideas. Number one, we have an emphasis on the burning bush. And the emphasis in this particular section is on God is holy. And because of the holiness of God, you cannot approach Him without a mediator. And by the time we get to the end of the book of Exodus, we will have a method and a means whereby a perfectly holy God can be approached by sinful man. Following that, God gives Moses a commission, and the commission is in chapter 3, verses 7 through 12, which you've already covered. Then probably one of the most pivotal things in the book of Exodus is the emphasis on the name of Jehovah. Chapter 3, verse 13, and let's read those two verses. Because essentially, the rest of the book of Exodus will be answering the question, who God really is. Verse 13, Moses said to God, "Behold, I am coming to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they may say to me, what is his name?" And as we emphasized in our last study, name in Old Testament terminology equals character. You could never satisfy if you would say, "What is his name?" and respond by saying, "His name is Charles." That would not be an answer as they would understand it, because name refers to what's he like, what's his character, what's his essence, what does he do, how does he think, how does he live, how does he act, and that would all be wrapped up in the idea of his name. So they may say to me, what is his name? In other words, this God that you're talking about, what's he like, what's his character, what makes up his essence, what shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And that's the point at which we said the name of God is given in very short form in Hebrew as YHWH. No vowels in Hebrew as far as writing is concerned, YHWH, and that is, again, the name that we've sounded out as Yahweh. And essentially, the rest of the book will be simply saying, who is Yahweh? Yahweh simply is the verb form that means I am. And if we had put down in our mentality the word I am with a blank after it, that we will find out the rest of the book of Exodus, the actions that God is taking as he begins to deal with Pharaoh are simply saying, I'm going to let you fill in the blank, and you're going to discover by seeing what I do, who I am. You're going to find out that I am a warrior and that I go to battle against the gods of Egypt. And you haven't heard that up to this point of time. Abraham had not, Isaac had not, no one had learned this up to this point of time, but you are now going to learn it. You're going to learn that I'm your salvation, you're going to learn that I am your supplier of food in the manna and the water, and you're going to find out many, many things. The essence of the revelation of Exodus is going to be to fill in the blank on who God is, and the more we study the book, the more you're going to see that is going to be the case, that in a brand new way, God is going to say, I'm going to put new information in the blank after the word I am so that you will really learn who I am. And this will become very essential to the entire book of Exodus. And again, and I recognize this is probably repetitious, but it is important. You can recognize the name I am either in your Bible as translated Jehovah. Jehovah is the word I am, or the word Lord. And for I am to be the word Lord, it has to be all in caps. L capital, O capital, R capital, D capital is the way our version puts it across. Or sometimes God, all in caps, each letter capitalized, or sometimes simply as a translation of the verb, you will see I am. Any of those forms. Simply wipe out in your mind, put the word I am or the word Yahweh in the place of those things, And you have it. I do not know why the translations have not given us conformity all up and down the line on these things, but that nonetheless is the way it is. And I think that takes in King James and so forth. The least likely sounding of God's name is Jehovah. Very good approach to Jehovah Witnesses is to say the first thing you people ought to do is to learn who God is and what His name is, because you're not even saying the word God correctly. And Jehovah is not correct. It is the word Yahweh. Then finally, Moses is given the message, and that's where we stopped last time. And in the message given to Moses, you have an emphasis, number one, on Israel's God. And that is in verses 15, 16, 17, 18. And we have, number one, His name, verse 15. God furthermore said to Moses, "Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord," and notice that's all in capital letters, so it is the word Yahweh, "Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name," expressing His character, "forever. This is the memorial name to all generations." And so when he talks about His name, he's talking about the objective revelation of his nature. Second, we have an emphasis on Yahweh's concern. And His concern is expressed in verse 16. He says, "Go, gather the elders of Israel together, say to them, the Lord," and notice that's all in capitals, it's the Hebrew word Yahweh, or I am, "Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt." And let me just give a little note at this point. When God says He is concerned about you, you are using a word that means concern that results in an action. It's inevitably a concern that eventuates in a saving action. The question I'll drop at this point of time, or the observation I guess we'll make at this point of time, is as God expresses His concern for Israel in slavery and begins to move in order to save them, things get much, much worse. Why would God's concern and God's action make things get worse? It seems like they would get better. We will find by the time we get to chapter 5 that things are really bad. And Israel, even as a nation, sits up and takes notice and says, "Moses, since you went and tried to get our delivery, it's been all downhill." Why would things go downhill to all appearances when God says, "I'm concerned about you and I'm going to deliver you"? Well, we'll find that that is there. It's a principle in God's working, and we'll want to see why. Third, after His name, His concern, we have His delivery, or His promised delivery. Verse 17, "Because of my concern, I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite and the Hittite and the Amorite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite, to a land flowing with milk and honey." Reading once again the first words of verse 17, if you're acquainted at all with the Scriptures and the way God works, verse 17 reads, "So I said, I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt in my own time and on my own schedule, which will not be your time and your schedule." And we'll see how that works out. But nonetheless, you have a promise of delivery in verse 17. Second, we move from Israel's God to Israel's request. And the request comes down in verse 18. It would be 15 through 17 for Israel's God. Israel's request, verse 18. God says, "And they will pay heed to what you say. You with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, the Lord," and again notice all in capitals, "Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. So now please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. Several things we need to do at this point. First is noticed in verse 18, they're only requesting a 3 day journey into the wilderness. And had you been the Pharaoh, what would you have expected? I think it's fair to say from the request to go 3 days journey into the wilderness that you would expect them after 3 days to do what? To come back. And yet, at the same time, when you go back to verses 16 and 17 to what we just read, God has promised not a 3 day delivery. He's promised, I will bring you out of Egypt and put you in the land of Canaan. And the question that arises at this point, and it's where we stopped last time, is, does God tell Moses to tell a lie? Is he saying, look, if you ask for complete delivery, you'll not get it. So let's lie to Pharaoh. Let's ask for a 3 days journey. And after the 3 days journey, which is a reasonable request, after that is granted, then you can take off for the land of Canaan and you can run from Pharaoh. In other words, is God telling Moses to tell a lie at this point? Because, obviously, their intent was not a 3 day journey into the wilderness. Their intent was a complete delivery from Pharaoh and from the land of Egypt. Now, what is the solution to this? I think the solution is simply this, that God tells Moses, start with a reasonable request. 3 days journey into the wilderness to worship your God is not unreasonable, and make one that any reasonable king would have to grant. And as a result, that request is designed to show you something. Pharaoh is so hard in heart and so resistant to the God of Israel that he won't even give you a 3 day pass into the wilderness. In other words, the refusal of a simple request is going to teach us the kind of man that will appear on the following pages. And that, in turn, is going to serve as a backdrop to show that this man is so hard that no amount of reasoning and pleading on your part, you could not be reasonable enough to overcome the hardness of Pharaoh. Therefore, the delivery is going to be dependent upon what? It's going to be dependent upon the power of God. So what it really does is this request lays a backdrop for, first of all, the hardness of Pharaoh's heart, and second, for the power of God that's going to be demonstrated in the following verses. In other words, Pharaoh won't even grant a reasonable request. That does, incidentally, fit in with some of the extra-biblical historical background, because you do have instances in Egypt of little groups who worship their own particular god making a request for a special season to worship their god, and over again it was granted. Sure, you can go a day, 2 days, 3 days outside of Egypt to worship your god, and the assumption is that you will come back, and most reasonable pharaohs granted it. This pharaoh is so unreasonable that not only will he not grant the request, but he will say, you have no right to make a request like this, and not only is that the case, I am so offended by the request that I'm going to make your labor much more. So this is all set up to show how hard how hard Pharaoh really is. And so if you read verse 19, God tells Moses beforehand that this man has an enormously hard heart, which is what we're going to see. He says, I know that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. In other words, we're going to have to force the issue. All right, following this, you have in verses 20 through 22 a promise of Israel's success. And the success is promised in verses 20 through 22. And in these verses, we will have the two reasons that Israel will be successful. Reading verse 20. He says, so I will stretch out my hand, strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it, and after that he will let you go. Israel's success is spelled out for two reasons. she will be successful, number one, because of the power of God. Verse 20. First reason, here is the announcement of the miracles by which God is going to glorify Himself. He will use the miracles that He puts in Moses' hand in order to display His power and bring them out. Second, verse 21, I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. That's not the Pharaoh, but that's the population, the citizens. The Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and the woman who lives in her house articles of silver, articles of gold, and for clothing, and you will put them on your sons and daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians. So I think, first of all, in verse 20, Israel is successful because of God's power. And in verse 21 through 22, she is successful because of the sovereignty of God. How do you explain verses 21 and 22 apart from the sovereignty of God? You women could identify with that, can you not? Some friend or someone who works for you says, I would like all of your diamonds, all of your jewelry. And you say, oh, sure. You hand it over to them, right? I would like also all of your clothing, if you don't mind. Please give that to me. And you cannot explain verses 21, 22 apart from the sovereignty of God. And it's there. He says, I will grant this people favor. And so God, on the hearts of the Egyptian women, moved for them to give up their jewelry to the Jewish women, and thus they come out with great riches. There are three passages that really fit here, and they figure in this way. This coming out with great riches, first of all, is prophesied. And it's prophesied in Genesis 15, 14. We'll go to these in a minute. Second, going out with great wealth is promised in Exodus 3, where we are right now, 21 and 22. And the means to get this done is commanded in Exodus 11, 2 and 3. And the coming out with great wealth is executed, or it is successful, in Exodus 12, 35 and 36. Let's look at each one of those, because as you can see from the range of passages here, that this is an important thing that God is saying, is that when you come out of Egypt, you will not come out broke. You will come out with great wealth. First, Genesis chapter 15 and verse 14. Notice this is the prophecy of that fact. Promise that it is going to happen. 15:14. Well, 13 to get the entire context. Remember, the book of Exodus is the fulfillment of Genesis 15, verses 13 and 14. In verses 13 and 14, this is only a far distant promise. We're now seeing it fulfilled in the book we're studying. Verse 13, God said to Abraham, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs. And that's where we are in the book of Exodus, where they will be enslaved and impressed 400 years. And that's where we're seeing the people we're studying in our study in Exodus. But I will judge the nation whom you will serve. We have not arrived at that point yet. That will be in Exodus chapter 12, the fulfillment of it. And afterwards they will come out, that is the Exodus, with many possessions. So one detail of the prophecy is when I bring you out of Egypt, you will come out and you will come out wealthy. Second passage, Exodus chapter 3, and we have just looked at it. Notice the reaffirmation of the promise made to Abraham. chapter 3, verse 21, I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed. And he gives some of the details of how this is going to come about and how you are to ask of your neighbor the fulfillment of this. Very interesting point here is God made a promise in Genesis that you will come out wealthy. But will there be any means, any responsibility on your part to see that that's fulfilled? And the answer is, yes, there is responsibility, and it's all wrapped up in verse 22 in the verb ask. You shall ask of her neighbor. And I would take it that the promise of God is fulfilled only in the measure that the individual women asked. I'm sure there were some timid souls who said, would you give me your tiniest diamond? And they got the tiniest diamond. There were others that I'm sure related to God's promise, and they said, we want all of your diamonds. And they got all of the diamonds. And that is always true in relationship to God's promises. We get only the benefit of the promise that we ask for. We get only the benefit of the promise that we take by faith. God promises it. The riches of it depends on how much we are willing to ask and how much we are willing to appropriate. All right, the execution of it, or the command to do something, is Exodus 11. Maybe my illustration is poor. These were Jewish women. No Jewish woman would ask for the smallest diamond. They would ask for all of them and the right to search the house for more, wouldn't they? Okay. Chapter 11, verse 2. We're ready for the Exodus. And in verse 2, God says, speak now in the hearing of the people, that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And I'm sure that's put there because the request would be ridiculous in verse 9 unless God put his power behind it. It's not a normal thing to do to give away your articles of silver and gold. So the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and the sight of the people. And then finally, it is executed in chapter 12. 35, 36. It says, now the sons of Israel had done according to the word of Moses, for they had requested from the Egyptians articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing, and the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Notice in all of the accounts, emphasis on the fact that the Lord move these people to do this. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their request. Thus they plundered the Egyptians. So you have, again, closing out chapter 3, an emphasis on the greatness of the sovereignty of God. Now, I think right at this point, you have an Old Testament biblical principle. And we will state it by asking a question. Why did God insist by four passages that when they are delivered out of slavery, they do not come out empty-handed? Why does he insist that the delivery from the bondage also makes them wealthy? And we could answer two ways to that question. In the first place, because the redemption from Israel, from Egypt is a picture, simply saying that when the Lord delivers us from the bondage and the guilt and penalty of sin, we don't come out naked. We do not come out empty-handed. We come out rich. And that is the whole concept of the fact that when we appropriate God's redemption by faith, the cross work of Christ, we are given, we are imputed the righteousness of Jesus Christ, and we are made very wealthy. That is all rested, however, on the principle of Deuteronomy 15. Part of the law of Israel stated in Deuteronomy chapter 15. part of the justice in the legal system of Israel is that when you release a slave, you dare not send him out empty-handed. Chapter 15, verse 12. If your kinsman, a Hebrew man or woman, is sold to you, then he shall serve you 6 years. But in the seventh year you shall set him free. And when you set him free, you shall not send him away empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally with your flock and from your threshing floor and from your wine vat. You shall give to him as the Lord your God has blessed you. Principle all the way through in the Old Testament is when redemption is accomplished, when an enslaved person is freed, they are also sent out with full resources. They are never set forth in order to be poor in the Old Testament. All right? We're looking at the call of Moses, the bush, the commission, the name, the message, and now we're ready for chapter 4. And chapter 4 focuses on the signs of Moses. Chapter 4, 1 through 9. And we'll divide that into two parts. Part 1 is the problem, and part 2 will be the signs. First of all, 4, 1, the problem. And the problem, in essence, is this. Moses says, look, I accept the reality of your appearance to me, but I have a problem. How am I going to convince people that you've appeared to me? So notice the way chapter 4, verse 1 begins. Then Moses answered and said, what if they will not believe me? In other words, I'm not doubting that you really appeared to me, but I do see a problem. How am I going to tell this to people? What if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. And that is a very real problem. Suppose I would had the task this morning of convincing you that when I got out of bed this morning, standing by the bed was the Jolly Green Giant. He was there. I saw him with my own eyes. What amount of argument would ever convince you of that truth? And I'm sure I might as well go home, because there's no way I could ever convince you that I saw the Jolly Green Giant by my bed. There's just no way. You would say you had an illusion. You would say it was a dream. You'd have all kinds of things, but you do not believe I saw the Jolly Green Giant this morning, do you? I did. And you don't believe it, do you? That's Moses' problem. I'm going to go back and say, the Lord appeared to me, and they're going to say, sure he did, you know. And that's the problem of chapter 4, verse 1. And he's very realistic. All of Moses' objections are realistic. We look at some of his objections, and we may criticize them because they counter the Word of God, but they're all realistic. Moses said, I am not the person that ought to go to Pharaoh. I am not eloquent, and I am not capable. And the following events are going to prove that Moses was absolutely 100% right. And it's going to upset him very much. But nonetheless, notice the problem that we've got in verse 1. Now, the solution to the problem is in the signs. And the solution follows in 4, 2 through 9. And God will give to Moses 3 signs. Number 1, he will give him the staff sign. And that will be in 4, 2 through 5. Then he will give him the leprosy sign. And that will be in verses 6 through 8. And then he will give him the blood sign. And that's in verse 9. Beginning in verse 2, the staff sign, and simply reading them through gives adequate explanation. The Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, a staff. Then he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And this was all an illusion. What do the next words say? And Moses fled from the illusion. He fled from the illustration, right? A little incidental proof that that was really true. This scared Moses. He threw it on the ground and it became a serpent, and he did what you would normally do when you see a serpent. He fled from it, pointing to the reality of the miracle. The Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand, caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. I think that may be one of the most noble acts of faith. Would you? And the point is, verse 5, that they may believe that the Lord, notice, Yahweh, the God of their fathers, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, and God of Jacob has appeared to you. Notice, by the way, how much effort the book of Exodus puts into tying the word Lord or Yahweh into what? He is the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham. In other words, you're learning about Yahweh that Abraham did not know. But make no mistake, the same God. You're just getting more information and more truth about him. So, verse 6, you come to the staff sign. The Lord furthermore said to him, now put your hand in your bosom. So he put his hand into his bosom, and he took it out. Behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then he said, put your hand into your bosom again. So he put his hand to his bosom again, and when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. And then the purpose, it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. But if they will not believe even those two signs, or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile, pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. So God, he's given three signs. Following this, you have in the account of Exodus the use of those signs, and he will use them before two groups. He will use them before Israel, and he will use them before Pharaoh. First of all, before Israel, chapter 4, verse 29. Verse 29 of chapter 4 says, then Moses and Aaron went, assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel, and Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people, so the people believed. So, to Israel, the response was positive. He also performed them before Pharaoh in Exodus 7, verse 8. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, saying, work a miracle, then you shall say to Aaron, take your staff, throw it down before Pharaoh, that it may become a serpent. And so Moses does that. And the same thing happens. The result is negative. Observation. Miracle signs to those who already believed found them believing more. A miracle performed before those who were already unbelieving left them unbelieving. So in essence, the signs given here did not convince, they confirmed. So noting here, the signs did not convince, but confirmed. They did not convince the unbelieving. They confirmed truth to the believing. How about the miracles in the life of Christ? Basically, they did not convince. They confirmed. You come to the turning of the water to wine in the second chapter of the Gospel of John. And the concluding words there are, after the turning of water to wine, his disciples, that is those who already believe, learned to believe more. And to the rest, essentially, they did not do anything. And therefore, these miraculous things are confirming to the already believing. They are not convincing to the already unbelieving, as we'll find in the following context. All right, we're ready to move, and we'll simply put up the caption for our next study. We're going to find to this call of Moses, resistance. And the resistance of Moses will be chapter 4, beginning at verse 10, down through verse 17. And we will come to his resistance taking two forms, the milder first, the stronger second. First of all, resistance in form of excuses. And that will be in verses 10 through 12. And when Moses runs out of excuses, he simply just says, I won't do it. You send somebody else. So we'll move from resistance in the form of excuses to resistance in the form of absolute refusal, which will be in verses 13 through 17. We'll pick it up in our next study. Father, we're thankful today for your word. May we study it in order to obey it in Christ's name.